Florida Basketball, our podcast, is brought to you by the Gatorverse, an exclusive community dedicated to connecting University of Florida fans and student-athletes. Members receive access to exclusive autographed collectibles, real-life experiences, giveaways, VIP events, rewards, and athletes receive a majority of revenue from sales of their collectibles. That's the way that NIL is supposed to work. To find out more about becoming a Gatorverse member and Lockermania, visit Gatorverse.io. That's Gatorverse.io.
Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. I am Neil Blackman, Saturday Down South. On this episode, I will be joined by Eric Fawcett, GatorCountry.com, getting the band back together. It's been a little bit. Sorry about that, guys. I had a medical procedure done. A major surgery. I'm doing fine. Really starting to recover and feel a lot better. So in any event, it's kind of prevented me from doing the pod for a couple weeks. So it's good to be back. Because it's been a little bit, we're going to go ahead and kind of invert our typical process, which I think, you know, is obviously a little different for us. But we're going to talk about Florida's upcoming game, which is tonight first. That's the ECU game. And what I'll say as we get ready to discuss ECU is they can play, man. I mean, they are 6-4, but I think the thing to understand about ECU is that they've challenged themselves. They've gone out. They haven't played nobodies. They haven't really beat anybody that I would consider to be a quality team, except for UNC Wilmington. But the UNC Wilmington victory is kind of eye-opening, right? Because we know if you follow the sport, we know, and you're listening to us, so you do. We know UNC Wilmington went to Rupp. We know they won at Rupp. And that was a team that Furman – East Carolina handled. So that was, you know, and it's important to note that they handled them 2 days before ECU or before Wilmington went to ECU and beat, golly. I'm going to start the whole show over. No, I'm not. I'm kidding. Look, East Carolina beat Wilmington. And then 2 days later, what happens? Well, what happens is, you know, they went right over to Rupp Arena, Wilmington did, and beat up on Kentucky. So, and that wasn't a fluke. Like, there was nothing about that game. DJ Wagner didn't play, but there was nothing about that game, that Wilmington win at Kentucky, that was flukish. Like, it just sort of, you know, it was a quality win. So, point being, that's who ECU is capable of beating. I thought the other eye-opening kind of ECU performance for me was what they just did at home against South Carolina over the weekend. And, you know, before you poo-poo it and say, oh, South Carolina's no good, like, South Carolina's a team that started the year, like, well out of the top 50 in KenPom. They've improved to a top 50 KenPom team, and their only loss is to unbeaten Clemson by 5 on the road. Like, otherwise, they have just beaten everyone they've played, and only one of those games, Virginia Tech, was decided by one possession or less. So it's not like that's not a team that can play, and they were right there with them too. So I think those two kind of things make it a little more interesting than I like when I scheduled it. I did not think that this game was going to be terribly challenging for Florida. I still don't think it's going to be terribly challenging for Florida. And because it's in Lakeland, it's not a true neutral site. It's what the computers consider like a semi-home game for Florida. So, you know, I don't know if that gives it a computer bump or not, but what I'll say as we welcome in Eric is that Mike Schwartz has improved ECU every year, and they can play. They are not a team that – this Florida team, which really struggles to defend at times, can take lightly. And They're also getting a huge boost thanks to federal law. So, you know, Cam Hayes, he might only play for 2 weeks, but one of those games will be tonight. And he played pretty well against Florida last year, scored 8 points, had 4 assists, a couple steals. So, like, decent player. But certainly somebody that gives their, like, backcourt a punch that it lacked down the stretch in the South Carolina game, which they probably would have won if they could have scored the ball a little better, Eric.
Yeah, I'm just still really interested in who is going to be playing. That was previously, you know, going to be ineligible or what the situation is going to be for these 14 days. I was even waiting last night on Wednesday night. It wasn't a super heavy slate, but there was a couple players on a couple of teams that about 6 hours after the ruling was laid down, had to have the make the decision of whether or not they're going to play these guys and kind of see what happens. Essentially, I can tell you this much: coaches have told me there are some that are going to play their guys and put double birds up and see what happens after it, and are willing to live with whatever happens next. And given what has happened to the NCAA in court in many situations, they usually lose in court.
They're taking a lot of L's.
That's just, you know, objectively speaking, their record book shows the NCAA does not do very well when challenged with these things. So, yeah, that's my way of saying I'm very interested to see what happens with Hayes, who of course would be a pretty big jump. And the thing with these players is, like, it's not guys that are injured or suspended. So it's not like. Like, I'm not saying he comes in and is at 100% if he does, but it's not a situation where a guy has been, you know, not playing for the last month or because of injury or suspension. So that's what makes these guys even more interesting, is the fact that presumably it would be like, I mean, obviously this is not a one for one, but like, you know, Zion Pullen came in and was instantly effective. Very good. That's because I think Zion Pullen he's also a much better player than a lot of these guys seeking two-time waivers. And maybe that's part of the reason some of these guys are seeking two-time waivers. But yeah, I do suspect some of these teams are going to get a pretty sizable boost. And I think that Hayes would get one. But just more on the East Carolina topic, just as I got into the recording, I heard you mention that you didn't think it was going to be a particularly challenging game when the Gators scheduled them. I actually thought it was going to be a pretty good game. And I think that anyone with KenPom can look at this, but I think this kind of would mirror kind of my expectations. And like, for example, I think that a lot of people, when the Gators scheduled Richmond, thought, oh, this is going to be a challenging game. Well, Richmond came in 126th in KenPom to start the season, and East Carolina right. was 130th. So, okay. And again, I think that probably is because East Carolina is going to be, for a lot of people, East Carolina is probably higher than they thought. Richmond is lower, or was probably lower than they thought, because Richmond usually lives in that 60 to 80 range. Richmond, of course, has been a little bit better than their preseason, and East Carolina is currently at 204. So obviously East Carolina has dropped a whole bunch. But kind of the reason they tanked so much, they dropped like 60 spots in KenPom in two games. They lost to USC Upstate, who is not good. They lost to Northeastern, who is not good. And but at the time, they were missing Brandon Johnson, who's one of their most important players. Or if you wanted to look at how they've played before this or while he was injured versus now, you could say their most important player. So, of course, now that they're back to full strength, you see them play really tight against South Carolina, who South Carolina has been a lot better than people think. So I think what makes East Carolina really special, just relative to most teams at the mid-major level, particularly at the AAC level, is they were able to bring back most of their guys that were effective. RJ Felton was a very effective player, and a 6'3", 210-pound guard, someone with, you know, high major size, doesn't shoot the ball well, but he's productive and has good size for the guard position. He came back. Brandon Johnson, 6'8", 225 pounds, you know, not quite. Maybe he's best at the five, so maybe he's a little bit undersized at the high major level, but he's productive and has size. And obviously we've seen can be a very effective player. He's back, multiple year player in his third year. Ezra Asuor, 6'8", 250-pound senior, was really, really good as a freshman, I thought. Like, for a player to start and be productive as a freshman, at the AAC level, and be, you know, a guy who averages double digits and can really rebound it and has good size, like, those are guys that usually jump. So those are three players that I think are very important that returned. And it's just like, if you would have told me at the end of last season, does East Carolina keep these guys? I would have said, like, no, there's no possible way. So the way that they're able to bring them back is very impressive. And that's kind of why I thought that they were going to be pretty good. And they were 180th in KenPom last year. So I kind of thought, oh, you bring all these guys back. They did pretty well in the portal to get Bobby Pettiford, a guard from Kansas, who, again, didn't play a lot, but was a top 100 player that went to Kansas. So that usually says something. And if you actually look around the league, guys that started at Kansas and transfer to go down a level, those guys have historically been very good. So Bobby Pettiford, I think, is really good. And, you know, I didn't expect Cam Hayes but to play, did not certainly didn't expect what happened yesterday, but that's obviously a good level of talent. So I just look at this team and just like I just see guys that I thought could have ended up on high major teams, not saying that they would have been super productive players, but I would have saw guys that could have absolutely jumped. And then you look at some guys who were, you know, capable high major players that transferred down. So yeah, I actually think East Carolina is very good. And then the last thing I'll say, well, for now, is what makes them maybe a concern for the Gators is Brandon Johnson and Asuor, who are 6'8", 220 pounds and very strong at the four, and 6'8", 250 pounds at the five, that are very strong. And those are the kind of bigs that I think have given Micah Hanlockton major issues. Again, we've talked about it so many times in the bye games earlier in the season, when you're like, hey, did you see that Loyola Maryland had a 6'8" strong guy who came in off the bench and scored 12 because he was bodying Micah Hanlockton and Alex Condon? Like, well, we've had those conversations a couple of times, and I think that East Carolina's bigs are better than some of these low major bigs that have already been really effective against Florida. So I actually, you know, I'm not predicting an upset. I'm not anything like that, but I think that this team is really good. I think they're arguably more talented than Richmond. I think Richmond's best guys are at another level, but I think past that there's depth to this East Carolina team. And I also think that Richmond's style was maybe not, just as we compare them as teams that started the season similarly in KenPom, and I think it's interesting they started so similar to KenPom, but people had pretty wildly different views of them. I think that Richmond is, you know, I do think Richmond's a better team than East Carolina, but I think that their style, the Princeton offense was not the best to attack Florida, where I think East Carolina's offense is going to be more suited to attacking Florida.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I think, like, while they're kind of like, they're small, because one of their transfers that they, well, I guess it was one of the freshmen that Mike Schwartz signed in his like first full class. Sire Malonga hasn't played much. And that would be like the guy that would give them length and like shot blocking, which they were pretty terrible at last year. They're still not blocking shots. So they kind of have to guard you for 30, you know, seconds. And they, the way they play, which is slow, they seem okay with that. And I think you mentioned Brandon Johnson, who I think is maybe one of the best players in this game, not just on ECU. That maybe that's a hot take, but I think he's really good. He had 18 points, 11 rebounds against UNC Wilmington, who then went and beat Kentucky at Rupp like 48 hours later. You know, he has posted multiple double-doubles since coming back, three. And by the way, Brandon Johnson is like a great example. Like, we could go down a whole rabbit hole on like players like Brandon Johnson, where they go to public school and they don't end up going to like one of these big basketball factories. And that's where like football recruiting and basketball recruiting are still different, right? Like, football, they find you. They find you. Basketball, not always. Like, you know, maybe not even most of the time. Like, if you're not at a private school where there's going to be more eyes on you and you're playing in big tournaments and things like that, it can be tough. So you got like Brandon Johnson, average like a double-double in North Carolina high school basketball. You'd think that they would find him. But because it was a small little school on the outskirts of Raleigh that played in like a middle classification, like, you know, his offer list was like very small. And he has outplayed it. And he's worked really hard, I think, to become like a more versatile player. Like, I was impressed that he's like shooting 35% from beyond the arc, because he's normally like earlier in his career, he was more like Eric said, like he was just kind of an undersized post. But now he can get out like far enough and shoot and stretch you out, which I think will be challenging to Florida's younger front court players who aren't as strong and who are much more content to guard like closer to the basket right now, I think. But he's a guy that's really good. You mentioned RJ Felton, who I think is their best defender. That's probably the area they struggle in, but Felton is like his cousin, Raymond Felton. Very good defensively and content to distribute. Not a good shooter. I mean, it runs in the family, I guess, Brick City. No, that's kind of mean to Raymond Felton, I guess. Well, not. It depends on if we're talking NBA Ray or college Ray. Look, they've got some talent. Mike Schwartz is another guy who I think is kind of an up-and-comer in the industry too. And, like, if you love Dr. Eric Fawcett, then you would love Mike Schwartz. Like, he was just a guy who happened to, like, play high school basketball. He ends up walking on at Texas. Like, I think Rick Barnes played him 1 minute. he played 1 minute for Rick Barnes at Texas, became like a video coordinator at Fresno State and then Miami, then became an assistant eventually after cutting tape for a while, and then like ends up on Rick Barnes' staff and wins like two SEC championships. And boom, like Joe Dooley gets fired. And ECU says, we want to do something different. And they get like maybe the most important schematic assistant that Rick Barnes ever had. That's a quote from Rick Barnes. So like that's what he said about Mike Schwartz, the most important schematic assistant I ever had. So, you know, pretty high praise, because you think about like Kim English being on that stat, like, right? Like, so Mike Schwartz can coach. He can coach. He's going to know what Florida's mismatches are. He's going to identify all that. He watches a ton of tape. He's a junkie. So like, I don't know, I guess I kind of thought this game wouldn't be as hard because of the front court situation, but like now I've watched ECU play and I realize like their lack of size is not really terribly prohibitive to playing against Florida. The other thing that I'm pretty sure they're going to be able to do is switch Florida pretty easily. Like, I'm not really like terribly worried about RJ Felton or Jaden Walker or any of them. Like, whoever gets matched up with like Riley Kugel or Zion Pullen is not going to be terribly bothered by their physicality. So Florida's going to have to execute, play well to win, and maybe see some of the defense that we saw in the second half of the Richmond game in particular, which I know, you know, Eric talked about that win a bit to you guys on the Patreon. We want to get into that, but I wanted to start with ECU because we don't typically record on a game day. And so like, I wanted to be able to tell people like, hey, minute 1 through 20 is your ECU preview.
Yeah. And I think that a couple other things that jumped out to me, and again, just in terms of the front courts, you mentioned Florida's young front court, Ezra Asuer, he is one of the best foul drawing players in the country. He was ninth the other day. I see now he has dropped to 12th in the country in fouls drawn. So he's drawing 7.8 fouls per 40 minutes. So, I think that, again, he's just someone when he's so strong and has that low center of gravity, like he's just kind of eating up younger, lankier bigs and baiting them into fouls. So that's going to be a concern. And then another just thing of note, because it just seems like when Florida wins, it's largely because of their offensive rebounding. So you always want to look at what's the rebounding, especially when you were talking about the size of East Carolina. They've been a solid defensive rebounding team, 143rd in the country, and they've been a very good offensive rebounding team, 33rd in the country. But I do think, of course, those numbers are not adjusted. And you need to, you know, of course, note that East Carolina has only played one high major opponent, and that's South Carolina. And other than that, have played, you know, some pretty poor teams, a handful in the 300. So I would suggest that those numbers are inflated somewhat. But at the same time, it's pretty clear that they are pretty solid on the glass, largely due to those two guys in the front court. And again, just the fact that both of those guys have good rebounding numbers in their careers. So I think it's fair to say that they are pretty solid rebounding, at least in that front court. And on the other side, though, they will commit some fouls themselves, again, being a little bit undersized in some matchups, again, playing in the AAC. And these guys have to go against like Houston, who, of course, has or did have to go against Houston last year. Luckily, they don't this year, but last year did. And Memphis and some of these teams with big front courts. High major front court, so those guys will commit some fouls. So we'll see if it goes kind of the other way. But I do expect Assur to get some dudes in some trouble and also get to the line a whole bunch. And yeah, I think those are kind of generally my notes on this one. But Neil, I am curious, just again, relative to I thought this was interesting. So Florida beat Richmond 87-76. East Carolina, the Gators are favored to win 87-71. I don't mean this from a betting standpoint. That's not really what we talk about here. But just like, again, this would be predicting somewhat of a blowout for the Gators. Do you think that the game is in the 87-71 range, or do you think that East Carolina keeps it closer?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be like in that 8-12 range, so a little bit closer. You know, because I've been impressed with, I've seen South Carolina a couple of times, not in person, but I've watched them. I've been pretty impressed with Lamont Paris's team this year, and they got all they could handle. Now that game obviously was on the road. And here, you know, there are going to be a lot of ECU Pirates fans in Lakeland. So a little different, but I do think there are some just matchup challenges that I, you know, to your credit, I did not anticipate them when I kind of looked at this matchup on paper. Had to watch ECU play a little bit. So, you know, one thing that's interesting, like last kind of point I'll make on ECU is that they just don't shoot very well. They shoot 31.8% from beyond the arc. Now, teams that don't shoot the three well have already shot the ball well against Florida, who, you know, we can get into that. I mean, Florida, I think I said Florida played great defense in the first half against Richmond. They really did. And then gave up like 1.22 points per possession in the second half. Like Florida's not played 40 minutes of defense all year. And like you give teams open shots, they're going to make them. I mean, Baylor made them. You know, everybody said, oh, well, Baylor shot the lights. And like to some extent that was true. But Baylor also, like if you looked at shot quality, like they had the hard shots they made were inside the arc. Like, you know, like on the shot quality chart, Eric, and this is same deal like Richmond on the shot quality chart, like the threes that they made against Florida, which was a lot, I think they made 10 or 11, most of those were clean looks. It wasn't like Florida was guarding well. So you know, Florida's got to do a better job out there, and I don't know if that's like kind of a good transition point, but that was what was eye-opening to me, like watching the Richmond game, was just Florida's inability to guard in the second half. And that made it hard for them to sort of pull away from a team that they looked clearly better than the first 20 minutes.
Yeah. And the last thing I'll say about East Carolina is like their shooting numbers are like not great, but not horrendous. But if you look at the guys that are actually shooting the ball well for them, they are guys who have historically not shot the ball well. So okay, I feel like I think they have the potential to even be worse than they currently are. Because again, you mentioned RJ Felton has not been a shooter in his career. He's shooting 36%. Brandon Johnson is shooting, I think, like you mentioned, like 35%. And that's a guy who has been, you know, I think shot 31 or 32. So they have some guys that also appear to be, you know, of course guys can improve, especially younger guys like Brandon Johnson. But I think that there's a chance that some of these guys are even shooting a little bit better than what they really are, and there could be some regression, but we will see. Neil, it is interesting you mentioned Florida's three-point defense, because I just wrote about this at Gator Country yesterday, and I found some fairly interesting numbers, I will say. And it's always, to be honest with you, one of the biggest struggles I've had in our long and illustrious niche podcasting career is talking about stuff that I wrote about, because I also just, I often feel like I'm just going to like read off a page. Just kind of throwing out some of the numbers that I really do think that there was some fairly interesting ones. And that would start with Florida's, I should really just pull this up. To be honest, I wasn't thinking we were going to actively talk about this, but you just brought it up. So I think that there's a lot of numbers that you want to look at. The first thing that, you know, any coach that's smart, in my opinion, or at least analytically minded, looks at three-point attempts. So if you look at where the Gators are in three-point attempts against, they're 99th. This is numbers from yesterday. They're probably not updated, but now I'm looking at my article. And it's kind of interesting, because the reason I wrote the article is because some people on Gator Country were like, it seems like the Gators are really struggling to guard the three-point line, and they're way worse than last year. And it's like kind of worth noting that if you have that opinion, and that's totally fair, we'll get into this a little bit more, but like last year, the Gators were 13th in the country in 3-point attempts against. And that's like in a good way, as in like they were like 13th lowest, I guess. So like Florida was one of the best teams in the country at eliminating 3-point shots last year. And this year they're really good. So if you're like, Matt, it seems like the Gators are like giving up a lot of 3-point shots, like they're really struggling, it's like, well, like 99th is pretty good. I'm sure that the staff would like to get even better, but it's like, it's just like last year was so good that this year by comparison is going to seem like they're giving up more threes. And then the other thing I think is worth noting is like last year, the Gators allowed only 5.8 made threes per game. And this year they're allowing 7.4 made threes per game. So that's a pretty significant leap. But Florida's tempo is also significantly faster. They were 70th this year. They were, 15th this year and 70th last year. So yeah, it's also
you're
like
gonna win that over under.
Let's
on tempo.
I think we'll be, it's looking positive, but I actually didn't even remember what the over-under was. We'll have to revisit the Jake numbers. Actually, it would be half interesting to give a way too early look at the over-unders show, but probably actually a foolish thing to do, but it would just be an opportunity to talk to Jake, which would be fun. So the Gators are allowing 1.6 more threes per game this year than last year. But they're also playing at a much higher pace. So it's like the mix of like there being more possessions in the game and the Gators giving up slightly more three-pointers from a rate standpoint is going to add to more threes. But and then Florida's teams are shooting 35.1% from three against the Gators, which is very high, above the national average. But I'm going to get to the interesting one, because this is where I struggle. I just feel like I'm reading off my article to people, which you can read at Gator Country if you so please. But there's a number that people will remember, potentially real ones who maybe read my stuff at Gator Country or listen to the podcast. And that is the important, I'll say important. I actually find this, I think this is a very important number that I quote to coaches all the time that I work with. So the average when it comes to catch and shoot threes at the Division I level, so 55% of catch and shoot threes on average are considered wide open by Synergy, and 45% are closely guarded. So a good chunk more are considered open than guarded on average. You will remember this potentially from my discussions in the offseason regarding last year when I argued that Florida wasn't a bad shooting team. They were bad at creating shots, because I don't remember the numbers in front of me, but they were shooting way less open threes than national average, which could be shot selection. In my opinion, it was just because they weren't creating shots. So, you know, what is the goal of a defense really when it comes to protecting the three-point line? First of all, it is to eliminate attempts. And second of all, if the attempts are going to happen, you want them to be closely guarded. So, I look at those numbers of like, okay, of the catch and shoot threes the Gators are giving up, are they closely guarded or are they wide open? So this was the craziest number I found. So Florida's breakdown of catch and shoot threes against, 42% have been wide open and 58% have been closely guarded. So again, the national, it's good.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
So 55% is on average, 55% of catch and shoots are wide open, and Florida's only giving up 42%.
Wow.
So Florida is well above. So, or again, 45% of catch and shoot threes at the Division I level are closely guarded, and 58% of Florida's. So that's what really stunned me, is to see that Florida is actually in my I'll give one last number and then I'll throw it back to you, Neil. So then I think you're then wondering, okay, so Florida's doing a pretty good job at eliminating catch and shoot threes and or eliminating 3-point shots, and they're actually guarding a good number of catch and shoot threes. So like, why is Florida giving up so many threes? Why is the percentage so high? So on the national average on a closely guarded catch and shoot three is 31.4%. And currently on closely guarded catch and shoot threes, Florida's opponents are shooting 36.5% from three. So my interpretation of those numbers would be that Florida is to some extent getting quite unlucky. Just looking at the fact that Florida's doing a pretty good but not great job of taking away 3-point attempts. They're doing a great job, in my opinion, based on the numbers, of contesting 3-point shots. But on those shots that they are contesting well, opponents are shooting a very, very high percent. So again, I will say to end my rant and throw it back to you, Neil, I think that to an extent the Gators are getting unlucky by shooters making tough shots that they are contesting. But the natural response to that still could be, well, like, there's some, like, clearly you're allowing guys to take contested shots that need to be allowed to take no shots. Guys that need to be, and I would say, if you break that down even more, look at Virginia. Virginia had some of their best shooters knocking down catch and shoot corner threes that were technically guarded. Well, you know, even a very good shooter, if closely guarded, is going to bang a pretty good number of corner threes off the catch. But yeah, so I would say, I think a lot of people are surprised by those numbers. Do you have any response to the mountain of information I just poured out?
No, I'm very surprised by the, by what you just said about unguarded. And then the national average actually surprised me. Like, that's, that's pretty, I mean, obviously I just sounded like an idiot, like, being like, that's not what you want. And then that's actually exactly what you want. So yeah, I mean, those are surprising. I'm glad you did the work on this, and I hope people read that article. I was going to back you up a little bit, like, cause you know, and I didn't do the deep dive, but I knew, for example, that like Michael Tine came into the game at the Orange Bowl Classic shooting 23% from beyond the arc. And then he goes 5 for 7 against Florida. Like, that's not always bad luck, but sometimes that's just bad luck. Like, he just happened to be on a heater that day. And I would say Florida ranks. So we've talked a lot about Florida's KenPom numbers and how like Bart Torvik numbers and how computers like this Florida team a lot. Shot quality loves Florida. Their shot quality is Florida in the top 10.
Wow.
So Florida's ranked 9th in shot quality in the country.
That's crazy.
They are ranked 3rd offensively in shot quality. And they are ranked 9th overall, and their record on shot quality is 7-2. And the only reason it's not 8-1 is that they lose the Merrimack game by 1 point on shot quality. They beat Baylor by double digits on shot quality. And they beat Virginia on shot quality. So their shot quality losses are literally Wake Forest and Merrimack. And anybody that watched the Wake Forest game, I think, knows that Steve Forbes just kind of clinicked Florida in the second half. And like one good sign, like one unofficial sign of a clinic, and real ones that listen for a long time know this, but when Eric is posting like a play you run like mid game, you know that like a clinic is probably occurring. And you know, even thinking back to like the early years of this podcast. Like, I think we've always kind of referenced Steve Forbes as like running great offense, and that's just kind of what happened. And that Wake Forest team plays really well at home. They did last year, and it looks like they're going to do the same thing this year. I mean, we thought Florida got it bad. Like, they humiliated a Rutgers team that a lot of people had pegged as a tournament team. You know, that game wasn't even competitive. Like, at least Florida led by 9 in the second half. So, you know, and it's, things are probably going to just get better for Wake with the federal court ruling. And then they actually got Efton Reed the waiver that they didn't think they would get, like, the game after the Florida game. So anyway, didn't mean to go on a Wake Forest tangent, but yeah, Florida's 7-2 shot quality. There is no undefeated team right now, from a shot quality record standpoint, because Arizona lost to Duke in shot quality. So, yeah, but the Gators are in the top 10, third in the SEC. So, you know, some of that backs up what Eric is saying, depending on your thoughts on the shot quality metric, but a lot of coaches like it. So,
yeah, like, yeah, I will be honest. Shot quality is not a tool I find particularly helpful to me, but there's always things that are interesting. And I guess, like, it would be interesting to see Florida's shot quality, like, defense, I guess, through shot quality. But yeah, and again, it's pretty interesting to see just early. And again, there's also a little bit of like regarding you being surprised that there's more open catch and shoot threes than contested ones in college basketball. I think it's just kind of the like selection bias, essentially, of like, if a shot is really, like, if it's really closely guarded, a player doesn't shoot it. So even then, those numbers can be kind of dubious, because if someone does a true, you know, the greatest closeout possible, that then the player receiving the pass in an opportunity to shoot is probably just not going to shoot it, and therefore it doesn't go down as a catch and shoot opportunity. Where it's like, if 95 out of 100 defenders would have allowed a catch and shoot attempt, and five of them are play such good defense, the shot doesn't go up. Well, you know, in most situations it would have been a catch and shoot attempt. So it's not a perfect number, but I think when it's, I look at it for a lot of teams, and I think it can be an indicator of a lot of things. So, and again, I think that everyone can, like, we can talk a little bit about the breakdown, and maybe someone could have issue with the classification of, okay, well, because shots are only considered, you know, if the closeout is so good, the shot doesn't even happen, and that doesn't be quantified. That is totally fair. I think that the number I don't want to say can't argue with, but like, when opponents are shooting above 35% on closely guarded threes, I think that was like the seventh worst in the country. I don't have it in front of me now, but you know, like, opponents bombing that percentage of shots. Could it be that the Gators have just played incredible shooting teams? No, they haven't. They have played some very good shooters. There was a couple on Wake Forest. There's a couple on Virginia. There's, of course, some on Baylor. But overall, I do think that Florida's 3-point, I don't want to say luck, but I did say that. Well, I guess I have to. I said the Gators were getting a little bit unlucky, so I will say luck. We'll improve a little bit. But yeah, you know what I'm generally interested in, Neil? I'll just throw this back to you. In the first couple of weeks of last season, we were like, wow, this Gators team can put up points and they can't guard. And then by the end of the season, it was so flipped and the Gators could not buy a bucket and were fantastic defensively. I don't remember some of the numbers we were able to pull, but it was like their poor start to the season defensively was so bad that, like, it seemed like the Gators were not going to be able to get like above like whatever 20th in KenPom just a defensive efficiency. But like, for the last couple of months of the season, they were playing like a top 6 or 7 defense. Like, do you think there's any possibility, as you talked earlier about the fact that Florida has struggled to guard and Florida has not put together 40 minutes of good defense? Like, do you think there's any chance that Florida does what they did last year and becomes a very good defensive team? And I mean, you can also, I guess, comment on the offense.
Well, I think that there's a chance that, like, if they can stay healthy, that they could become much better defensively, because they have been better defensively for the most part when Micah Hanlockton is on the floor, which makes sense because obviously he can protect the rim. So I think when they have a rim protector, I'm not saying you emphasize gap defense less. That's not the case. But I do think it makes help defense easier when you have a rim protector, right? Because, like, you don't have to pursue as much in your help. You can kind of cheat just a little bit because you know that there's somebody there that can help alter shots if it gets to the rim. And I do think that is helpful. But I think, you know, the other thing is I think Florida has good, like, on-ball defenders and defenders who can fight through screens that haven't played great defense yet. Like, I think we've seen flashes of good defense from Zion Pullen, but we've also seen some bad defense from Zion Pullen where he fouls too much, or, you know, he does struggle like adjusting to sort of getting into the gaps and playing defense at this level. I think we have seen really, really good defense from like one player all year, and that is Riley Kugel. And I was glad to see Todd Golden kind of say that at a recent press conference. Maybe that's harsh on Will Richard, but, you know, Will Richard, maybe I should say we've seen really good defense from Riley Kugel and Will Richard with minimal exceptions. Like, that's probably a cleaner take. and then, like, we've seen moments from Walter Clayton. We've seen, like, the beginning of the second half of the Miramax game, right? Like, kind of tone-setting defense from him. We've seen moments of it from Zion Pullen, especially like the job he did on Carlton Carrington in the Pitt game, the job he did on Cam Hildreth in the first half of the Wake Forest game before things just got all out of sorts. Like, those are really positive. Now, Pullen got in foul trouble, and we saw what happened with Florida in foul trouble and committing too many fouls. So, like, I guess it's sort of two things, like increased individual performances, particularly like some of the guys that are actually good on ball defenders, and then have the physicality to sort of refuse to be screened. They need to be better. And then I think Florida also, like, again, like those efficiency killers, like just constantly committing fouls and sending teams to the free throw line. That's improved a little bit recently, you know, but, you know, Florida hasn't had many games where they've committed less fouls than their opponent. For example, they did that against Richmond. That's good. That's progress. They still committed 16 fouls. Richmond still shot 20 free throws, you know? So, like, can Florida do that better? Because those are just free points. Even though Richmond only made 11 free throw shots, like, you're still really, it's harmful to your efficiency. And, you know, just how good your ceiling is defensively. I don't know if some of that made sense to you or not, but I feel like it's just, yeah. I mean, I kind of long-windedly described inconsistent defense. And, like, I do feel like it can get better because I feel like the pieces are on this team to be better.
Well, you just about, right in your last sentence, kind of answered what I was about to ask you. Like, again, Florida finished last year 31st in adjusted defensive efficiency in KenPom. I think they got as high as like roughly 20. But
yeah, I think that's right.
Let me ask you a question with heavy bias in my voice. Can you imagine a world where a team with Myron Jones and Jason Jatobo and I don't need to say anything. Could you imagine a world where last year's group of talent is a better defensive team than this year's? Like, I'm not even gonna ask a question anymore or remove any bias. Like, I think it would be pretty bad if the talent this year could not muster at least similar defensive output as last year's team. Like, do you think it would be a problem? Like, right now, Florida's 50th defensively. Last year, they were 31st. They played like a top 15 defense for much of conference play last year. Like, do you think it'd be a problem? Like, if this team could not muster a similar output defensively?
Yeah, I think it would be a problem. I mean, like, and keep in mind, like, you know, and I'm not saying this just because like this is Florida basketball hour, so this is just what I do. I'm not gonna lump Eric into that, but like Florida didn't even play like maybe their best on-ball defender last season. He sat on the bench all year. He's at Delaware now. So, like, you know, they like, and that's not like a knock on, I mean, there were reasons that he didn't play, right? All of them having to do with offense, really. Like, you know, but yeah, I mean, I can't imagine. I can't imagine that. Now, Colin Castleton, his ability to play tenacious defense in the post without fouling, covered up a lot of sins, just like Kavarius Hayes covered up, you know, just a terrible schematic flaw in like ball screen defense, right? But like pick and roll defense. Yeah, I mean, this sort of team, there's no excuse, because like in my mind, and this is something that at least synergy numbers defensively, like entering this season, kind of bore out, was that Walter Clayton might be like the weak link defensively of all these guards. And like Walter Clayton is not a bad defender. Like he's strong, he gets steals, he's active. So like that should be better, you know. We knew Zion Pullman was a big physical guard who could play defense, and he just hasn't done it consistently while making this jump. And then I think both of us mentioned like the stuff, and I remember because you said this might surprise our listeners, but the stuff Riley Kugel needs to work on, a lot of it was like, you know, decision making, like just things that have to do with offense. Like he's a big physical guy who's really strong, and he plays defense with a lot of energy and want to. And so he's done that this year, which is why, he's the only defender right now who's grading out at excellent in synergy other than Tyrese Samuel. He came in, Tyrese Samuel are it. And that surprises me on this roster, Eric.
Yeah, and I think what concerns me maybe the most about, like, just, and again, I know there's a lot of optimism right now, which again just speaks to Florida's style of play and how much people believe in it. Because again, I think if this was a couple of years ago, people would see the current record and the fact that the Gators haven't beaten a very good team, and they would be like, oh man, we're going to get killed in the SEC. Whereas like right now, the general vibe seems to be like, people love this team. Like people really support this team. They believe, yeah, the vibes are much better than in recent years. So I'm not trying to, you know, pour cold water, but if things didn't work out, I think this would be the reason why. Again, I truly believe Florida is going to be much better defensively than they currently are, largely because of the talent. We saw, again, Myron Jones be put in position to play quality defense last year, and that, you know, wasn't the case. There were some other guys as well that, not really known for their defensive acumen in recent years, that were able to play good to very good, very good defense. But while we're talking what could change, again, I've mentioned this in the past. It's something I will continue to track. But, you know, I'd make you guess, but it's cruel. It would be so difficult for you to do this. But, you know, I mentioned where Florida ranked in half court points per possession offensively this season. And it is now down to 187th in the country. And again, that's not an adjusted number for quality of competition. But at this point, you know, you should probably have some idea. And then, you know, Florida is a team that has played fast, prides themselves in their ability to do so. And as synergy loads, because I forget the number, Florida is 192nd in the country in transition points per possession.
Ooh.
So when you look kind of under the hood, you look at some of these numbers that, albeit are not adjusted, Florida's offense does not look very good. And if I wanted to be particularly cruel, I would point to a lot of numbers last year that look awfully, awfully similar to this year offensively. There are some eerily similar numbers.
Yeah.
However, this team is bludgeoning teams on the offensive glass. And that is why they have been not only decent offensively, but actually efficient offensively.
Yeah. A huge however.
A big however. So, and I kind of talked about this solo after Jacob Rudner got off the podcast, but like two things are kind of true right now, in my opinion. Florida has hit an efficient offense. They're also not a very good offense. So I think that the fear would be when you get into SEC play and some of the presumably the offensive rebounding slows down, maybe significantly, probably more accurately is somewhat. I still think Florida is going to be a fantastic offensive rebounding team in the SEC. But like at some point you have to be able to score, not just bludgeoning teams on the offensive glass. If you want to get to where this team wants to go. So I would predict that the Gators take a, I don't want to say serious, but I think Florida is going to take a dip offensively from an efficiency standpoint. There's just not enough, other than the fact that I do think the offensive talent on this team is very, very good. There's just not a lot based on last year that would suggest that the execution in the half court is going to get drastically, drastically better. And I do think that the offensive rebounding is going to go down. You know, hey, if you want to venture a guess, Neil, or a prediction, I would absolutely love to hear it. I have no idea where I think the Gators are going to finish in offensive rebounding this year, but this year they're fifth in the country. You know, hot take, I think that it'll be less. They'll be below that when they get into SEC play. If I had to guess, I think they'll be like top 25 or top 30, but instead, you know, that could be 4 or 5 offensive rebounds less per game, and that could be 5 or 6 points that are very valuable to this team that they would be missing. So I think they kind of have to get better defensively.
Yeah.
Because I just think that I think that there's too many under the hood offensive numbers that are concerning. But I also just am kind of stunned that this team is where they are defensively. And I think they're going to get a lot better. And I think it could be very similar to last year where we're a couple weeks in SEC play and we're like, hey, if you look at defense for just, you know, since January 1st, the Gators are like fourth in the country. Like I could see that happening, but yeah. What do you think when you see these like raw numbers, first shot offense, taking offensive rebounding out of the equation, like that are looking, you know, eerily similar to last year? What are your kind of reactions?
I wanted to bring up, well, I'm concerned about two areas. There's just two areas where I think Florida can be better. And one reason I mentioned like fighting through screens and stuff is like Florida's off screen defense is not good right now. Like it's just not. The numbers bear that out. The eye test bears that out. And then here's a shocking one. This will surprise you. This is a Hoopland's number. Florida's the only team in the SEC that's given up 25 points or more in two games on last 4 seconds of the shot clock points and baseline out of bound after timeouts. Like if you add them together, Florida's the only SEC team. In fact, only 6 other SEC teams even have one game where they've done that. Florida's done it twice, Wake Forest and Richmond. Just hemorrhaging points at the end of shot clocks. Like, and so like you talk about like wanting to push tempo and play fast, but that doesn't mean you can like lose your patience defensively and just forget to fight through a screen or forget a rotation at the end of a shot clock. Like Florida's been terrible in that regard. And I mean, this is kind of harsh words for me on a podcast. Like I'm sparing with the word terrible, but the shoe fits here. Florida's been poor to close to terrible on their after timeout baseline out of bounds offense. And here's some numbers that might like, I don't know. They may not surprise you, Eric. Maybe you've noticed this issue too, but so like Florida's given up 104 points on after timeout or baseline out of bounds plays at a rate of 0.957 points per possession, which is not good. The number of field goal attempts is 43 out of 92. So teams are shooting 47% on those plays. Their effective field goal percentage is 52.2. Florida's forcing turnovers after timeouts or baseline out of bounds is only 13.5%. The national average is 16.7. And then Florida has given up 11 three-pointers on baseline out of bounds or after timeout plays on 29 attempts. So that's 36%. None of these numbers are very positive. Like, and that's right after you talk to your coaching staff. So like, I doubt seriously that whatever's getting drawn up on the other side is fooling Florida so much that they're consistently getting scored on the situations. Like, to me, those seem like they're probably just execution and or focus errors where, like, you lose your guy after you come back in bounds, you know, like, and so I don't know. Those are problematic. And those are, like, if you're a big believer in correct the correctables, like, I've just mentioned two areas where, like, you can make obvious corrections. Like, you can defend for 30 seconds and you can fix the fact that you're getting worked on set plays, on baseline out of bounds and after timeout stuff. You have any thoughts on that or surprised by any of the numbers that I put up?
No, just when you were talking about threes allowed on baseline out of bounds, I think it was Richmond, but there was one where it was like the near corner on the TV broadcast. But it was the opposite. So like the opposite corner of where an inbound was, but like, again, there was an inbound where there was action happening towards the ball and they just left the opposite corner and they just
rifled the pass.
Okay. Yeah. I just said that. So yeah. Just like when you were talking about, like, again, that was like not even necessary. I'll say not even necessarily in action. Again, there's action on the strong side of the floor, which
right.
Kind of lulled. I think I remember who was defending that play, but I won't say it just because I'm not 100% accurate. But yeah, again, things like that. And it's also, this is the opportunity to plug. Well, why I don't, not an official sponsor of the podcast or anything like that. But you know, I mentioned I think it is good entertainment value if you are able to do so. When there's a timeout, you got to throw on the radio broadcast with Lee Humphrey and especially Lee Humphrey does this. But yeah, and I've enjoyed the radio broadcast both this year and last year. A lot more Kyle Crooks this year. That's been cool. Obviously Sean Kelly's very good, but Lee Humphrey's always listening to what's going on in those timeouts, and it's just like interesting because you never get it on the TV broadcast, but like Lee Humphrey. He's letting you know what he's hearing there from his vantage point by the court. So always interesting to see what Lee Humphrey says that he's hearing versus the execution. Those do not always line up, as you can imagine. So that's interesting. I will say my gut instinct to last the late shot clock numbers, like I do think that those are often can be unlucky. I would have to just look at the film because again, it's one of those things that like,
yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
I'm not going to inherently take it, but I would almost say like, that's almost one of those ones. Like offensively, we have talked for years about how Florida's late clock offense has been poor. And we were like, the Gators need some juice. Like they have no one who can create one-on-one. And that's usually what needs to happen at the end of a shot clock. And Florida did not have guys who could create one-on-one. And they had very bad late clock numbers that, you know, that seemed to support what we were all seeing. So I wonder if it is the inverse. You talked a little bit before about on-ball defense. Is there guys that are struggling or not doing good enough in those situations, or is it situations off screens, which again, the Gators have not been great at. I am glad actually earlier you mentioned, because the Wake Forest game was kind of in the jumble of Thanksgiving, of us both being busy and not being able to record shows. But yeah, in crunch time, Steve Forbes runs a play that was popularized by Belmont called Panic Backdoor, where they give the ball to a player who picks up his dribble, and it looks like the play has just completely, like they didn't execute the play right, and they lift three players kind of above the 3-point line rushing towards the ball. And it's actually all just a facade to set up a backdoor. And yeah, Belmont, oh, I'm blanking now who Belmont did it against. I want to say UCLA. Of course, Belmont popularized this play called the Panic Backdoor. You still see it come out from multiple teams every season, and Wake Forest in the clutch got the Gators on that one. And that one's almost like that is, I don't want to say it's a trick play, but it's like, you know, it's isolating a situation where everyone is rushing to the ball in what looks like a dead ball situation. And then it's a scripted backdoor. That's not one where I'm like, wow, what a breakdown by the defense.
Sure.
It was one of those ones where, again, and playing armchair quarterback. And I will say, on the bench of a professional team this summer. I saw teams try to run this on us twice. I was able to call it out twice because I saw the way it was setting up. Like, maybe I would have maybe loved for someone to have recognized this play, which is one of the most famous plays in recent college basketball history. But it was just an example of like when Florida has not been, or their execution has left a little bit to be desired on both ends of the floor late in game, to see someone run like a famous semi trick play against the Gators was a little bit of a like, oh, of course, you know, it's like, it was almost that kind of feeling. So yeah, but in terms of Florida's defense, it's also kind of the predictable guys that are, I don't want to say predictable as in they're bad defenders, but like, you know, it's been pretty clear that when Thomas Houck and Alex Connan are in the game, those are the guys they're trying to get to fight through flex screens. Yeah. And putting those two, those are the two, like, there was teams putting both of those guys in the same split action. Those are young guys. Those are tough to guard. But I still think like those guys don't lack for effort. They don't lack for length. You know, focus, maybe tough to say. But at the same time, you just, when you're looking up and down at this lineup and you're seeing like, oh, well, this guy is a good defender or should be a good defender. Oh, and this, like, I don't look at anyone like, again, sorry, Myron Jones, said his name a couple of times, but if you're like 6'2 and not athletic, that's a guy you can be like, okay, maybe you don't have high aspirations for this guy defensively. Yep. There's not a guy like that on Florida's roster.
No.
So, you know, I think it is fair to have some expectations of some better defensive performances.
Yeah. No, and that's why I'm glad you brought up like late shot clock defense and luck, because that's why I pointed out that stat. Like, I do think that's an interesting stat. Like, if that happens once, 25 or more points on out of bounds plays or last 4 seconds, like, okay, like, oh, maybe you had a weird day. Like, the fact that it's happened twice in 9 games, like, these are when trends, like, statistics tell stories. And like, that's one where you've data and you're like, wow, that's happened twice to them. Like, that's got to be better, right? You know, so another opportunity to get at it and fix it tonight. And then Eric and I are going to try to record another show before the Jumpman game, which I will say right now as we wrap up here, like, this is the biggest game of Florida's season. Like, it could very well end up like looking like that on Selection Sunday, which is a bizarre thing to say about a game that's like going to be a quad two game.
Well, like, if people don't know what's going on in Michigan right now, not the football team, it's its own thing. But the basketball team, I mean, go Google that. They're having issues off the floor, and they're having issues on the floor. This is a team that, again, started the season with a couple of big wins. Well, yeah, you know, they beat St. John's, and that was considered. They were like the small, like, give them the championship belt. Michigan was the way too early, small sample size championship winners of the season, because they like hammered UNC Asheville, who's good, hammered Youngstown State, who's good, hammered St. John's, who's good, but like none of those teams are great. And then everyone's just like, wow, this team's amazing. Like, everyone was loving on them. And then they like got hammered by, not hammered, but they lost by multiple possessions to Long Beach State. They lost to Memphis, lost to Texas Tech, lost to Oregon, lost to Indiana. Hey, those are all other than Long Beach State, who is Long Beach State, very good mid-major, probably going to see them in the NCAA tournament. But, yeah. You know, they've lost a lot of games, and now they have some off the court issues as well. So it's one of those things that, even like from a resume standpoint, who knows? Again, Michigan has lost to a lot of like Texas Tech is 50 in KenPom, Oregon's 39th in KenPom, Indiana's 78th in KenPom, Memphis is 33rd in KenPom. It's kind of like the Gators, but with more sample size right now, where they're like just not winning. They did beat Iowa, who's 59th, but like, again, it kind of looks like the Gators, who have that nice 47 KenPom win over Pittsburgh, but couldn't beat 58 Wake Forest or 24 Virginia. Like, they're struggling to win the games that they need to win if they're going to be an NCAA tournament game team. So again, this is a game with the Gators that, like, it's like, okay, you probably should be able to handle Wake Forest. Oh, you lost by double digits. Oh, like, you know, you probably like to see you take down Virginia. Oh, you didn't, but you know, it's, you know, that's not a terrible loss or anything. Like, at some point you have to beat these teams. So yeah, Michigan's kind of the last one where, like, I think if the Gators beat Michigan, you could say, okay, their non-conference was not a rousing success, but you could call it a good non-conference. If they lose to Michigan, I don't see how. There's a lot of people who are still arguing that Florida's, to this point, that Florida has been, had a really good non-conference. I think that is just not a fair thing to argue. There will be no discussion if the Gators lose to, lose to Michigan. I don't, there's not an argument you can make. No. So yeah, I do think it's important. Just vibes, vibes wise.
Yeah. And the Wake Forest game was just such a missed opportunity, like to be up 9, to really be in control of that game for 30 minutes and then just kind of collapse the way Florida did against the team. Like I write about the ACC and like, that team is going to finish. That Wake team is going to finish in the top 5 of that league. Now that they have Reed, Monsanto's going to play. Monsanto's going to play in a week. You know what I mean? Like, that's a painful loss because, like, that probably plays its way to a quad one, and you blew a 9-point lead with like 9 minutes to go because you stopped playing defense. You know, so yeah, they've got to beat Michigan, and it's strength on strength. Like Michigan is, for all their flaws, the one thing they do is shoot. So, like, you know, the discussion we had today, like, does Florida guard at the end of the shot clock? Does Florida guard the 3-point line? Going to be pretty important in the Michigan game. But we'll get to it after ECU. I'll let Eric sign us off.
Go Gators and keep attacking closeouts.